Brought to you by Bose, presenting their most advanced pilot headset ever, the Bose A20 Aviation Headset. It provides acclaimed noise reduction, along with a comfortable fit, clear audio, and Bluetooth connectivity.
Hello, I'm Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. There are very few people on this earth who can say that they've carried a space shuttle. And now that the shuttle program is over, the opportunities are dwindling. As shuttles are delivered to final destinations at select air and space museums nationwide, the mission of shuttle delivery falls to NASA's two modified 747 shuttle carrier aircraft and a handful of NASA pilots. Today we're speaking to one of them, Bill Brockett. Bill, thanks for joining us.
Really happy to be here, Glenn.
Well, let's dive right in. How many times have you had the opportunity to carry a shuttle?
I did my first shuttle mission in late 2000, right after going through the school for to learn how to fly the airplane, and then spending some time with existing qualified pilots. And I think it was November of 2000 I did my first trip, and I've probably flown 20 or 21 flights with the shuttle on board since then.
Can you share some of the highlights of the training experience? I wonder what that's like.
Well, the training is, it looks so different from a regular airplane. It seems like the training would be different. The requirement that NASA had was for an airline transport pilot certificate on the 747, the early series, the 100, 200 series. And that training was just a off-the-shelf Part 142 at United Airlines. I actually went through it with a crew from General Electric that operated another 747 as the engine testbed airplane. And we used United Airlines procedures and checklists to do the training and get the type rating. And once I had that in my pocket, then it was a series of local flights and one simulator refresher program that was a four-day simulator using shuttle carrier procedures, which are modified from the standard Boeing 747 procedures.
Now, these recent flights involve what I'd call some light showboating. They're flying past local landmarks and the like to provide the public with some photo opportunities. Are there specific safety protocols for these flights?
This is a one-of-a-kind national asset. The shuttles being delivered to the museums have become symbols of what United States technology and what NASA people have been able to do over the years. And so the FAA and the tactical security people and the security people at NASA were rightfully concerned with the possibilities of somebody trying to turn it into a different kind of statement. So every route, every flyby, every landmark was planned months in advance and reviewed by various committees that looked at it from different perspectives, and the final approval was provided by the people who are responsible for the shuttle program and at the highest levels in NASA. So each ferry delivery mission for a shuttle involved that level of review, and then the day before departure from Florida, or perhaps 2 or 3 days, it would be a final review in which all of these parties were conferenced in together and reviewed the entire plan. So this was not a haphazard or seat of the pants, or the pilots had very little discretion once it was time to go fly the plan. The plan was done, approved, reviewed, and then the pilots had input during that process. And actually, for an example, in the Los Angeles delivery, we went out about 3 weeks or so before the actual delivery flight and flew a practice trial run of the routing for two reasons. One was to get more familiar with the landmarks and the turn points and how we were going to fly the route, but also to allow a chase plane with a photographer on board to rehearse their role in the process and pick the best angles and have a plan in place before the flight on where they wanted to be with their camera to get the best shots.
Should we assume that there are ground and air, I guess I could call them security resources on hand for these trips?
Absolutely.
Well, let's get into some of the specifications about the aircraft. I believe that the lingo within NASA is the shuttle carrier aircraft is known as SCA. What sets this jet apart from a stock 747?
One of the things that I flew the airplane for a couple of years before I found out, I always called it a Boeing 747. But the official coding for flight plans is Bravo Sierra Charlie Alpha, which is Boeing shuttle carrier aircraft. And I think the primary reason it was set up as a separate aircraft type identifier is that although systems-wise it's a Boeing 747, performance-wise with the shuttle on board, it is nowhere close to a 747 in performance. But modifications that were made to the airplane were primarily structural reinforcement of the fuselage at the where the three attach points are that connect the shuttle to the airplane, and the installation of the tip fins on the horizontal stabilizer, which was to improve yaw control, yaw stability. But the big tip fins on the airplane are not rudders. They're just fixed stabilizers, so they make the airplane a lot more resistant to yawing.
How much does a shuttle weigh when it's prepared for transport?
Well, there are basically two scenarios for that. The shuttles that historically come back from space had a pretty big range of weights between, say, 205,000, 210,000 pounds up to 230-some-thousand pounds. And shuttles that were being moved from Florida to the Palmdale facility for modernization programs or upgrades, heavy maintenance, we could call it, the shuttle equivalent of a D-check, could weigh as little as 170,000 pounds. The shuttles that we delivered this year to the museums were more between 160 to 170,000 pounds.
Well, you touched on this before. What sort of performance does the SCA manage with and without a shuttle on its back? And I suppose just as important, how does it feel? What does it feel like in the cockpit to control the aircraft when a shuttle's on board?
From a pilot's perspective, when the shuttle is on board, there's a continuous kind of a vibration, and it's from the turbulent flow that comes off of the shuttle impacting the tail, and you feel it all the way through the airplane and through the flight controls, and it's continuous, and it's just a kind of a rumbling sound. It would be like driving an old truck with bad shocks, perhaps, but you can feel this kind of ongoing vibration all the time. We have three configurations to fly the airplane. The Type 1 configuration is the clean airplane without the tip fins installed and nothing on top. And then there's no restriction, just like any other 747. It hasn't been in that configuration probably since the late 1970s. The Type 2 configuration is the way it sits today without a shuttle on board. And the Type 3 configuration is with a shuttle on board. In the Type 2 configuration, in Type 3, there are speed limits on the airplane, which are 250 knots indicated airspeed, or 0.60 Mach. And given the weights and other constraints, the optimum cruise altitude in the Type 2 configuration would be around 25, 26,000 feet, and it would be around 360 knots or so, 360 knots true airspeed. With the shuttle on board, there were always constraints on the shuttle. There were absolute temperature constraints and pressure, atmospheric pressure constraints, because of the systems on the shuttle, which when we ferry the shuttle is not powered up. It's just inert, no power. So it's subject to cold soaking at altitude, and it can't be flown at an altitude that is colder than -9°C. And there's an absolute pressure limit. It turns out, obviously, that from season to season, the pressure altitude at which these temperature and pressure limits occur varies. So in the wintertime, we're down low. And there are places, I know going across El Paso, Texas, we can fly above about 11,000 feet and be within the envelope for the shuttle. It's not an airplane limitation. It's a shuttle limitation. The summertime, when the atmosphere kind of pups out and expands and you have the higher density altitudes, we could get up to 15 or 16,000 feet. But in the Type 3 configuration with the shuttle on board, that's about as high as we go. And there's a lot of drag, so at our cruise power settings, we're around 310 knots true. And that's partially because we're down at 15,000 feet instead of 26,000 feet. And we still have the same speed limits, 250 knots indicated or 0.60 Mach.
And how about flight dynamics? I guess what I'm asking is things like how much lift is the shuttle generating in flight? You've covered speeds and altitudes as a requirement of temperature, but how about for efficiency, or does that not factor in?
That really doesn't factor in because there are too many other constraints that efficiency is pretty much out the door. We're just trying to get the job done, and usually we're driven into a specific course of action, including leg lengths, available airports, by the weather and other considerations. One thing that's really interesting that probably most folks are not aware of is that the space shuttle is this vehicle that we built to launch on a rocket, and it goes out into the near vacuum of low Earth orbit, and it stays out there for days or weeks at a time, and then it comes back at tremendous speeds, many times the speed of sound, hits the atmosphere, slows down, and eventually comes in and lands as an airplane, as a glider. And it can do all of this, and it's been built specifically to do that, but it was not really built to be ferried. And so when it's in a cold condition on top of the shuttle carrier airplane, we do not fly through any clouds or moisture, precipitation, no rain showers. You know, we won't even go close to clouds. And the reason is the thermal tile, the tile protection system or thermal protection system on the shuttle, those tiles are designed to bring the machine back from space. They're not designed to be ferried around through rainstorms. So early in the program, well before I got there, thankfully, because it was not a good thing, the shuttle was flown through some rain showers, and they discovered terrible problems with erosion of a lot of the tiles, and they all had to be replaced. And that's a very expensive process. I can't tell you the numbers. They're available online, but how many this each tile on the shuttle is a distinct, unique piece. It has its own part number. They're all handmade, and they conform to the surface of the airplane that they attach to. And so it's very expensive when you damage those things. So that's a driver probably more than anything else. And a shuttle ferry mission, if the winds were perfect and we could do it in the most efficient way, would normally be two hops from Edwards, from an Edwards landing to Florida. That's only happened probably twice in the life of the airplane. We're much more constrained than most of the people out there flying because we can't fly through the clouds even. We fly daytime only so that we can see clouds or rain showers and avoid them. And that's really the driver. As far as efficiency goes, rough figures, we probably get about 20 gallons to the mile.
And looking at the flight dynamics, how is the shuttle perched on top? Is it set to generate lift? Is it set to be neutral lift? What?
I guess the interesting part of the shuttle configuration, the Type 3 configuration with the shuttle on board, is that those stubby little shuttle wings turn us into a biplane, and the place where we see it immediately is in the flap retraction speed schedule. We can retract the flaps at much lower speeds when the shuttle is on board than when the shuttle is not on board. So I think from flaps 20 to flaps 10 is only about a 10-knot increase in speed. And from when we have a runway-limited takeoff, we're using flaps 20, and we need to get them to flaps 10 for the climb-out segment, for the second segment climb performance. So it is a biplane. But in order to get that extra lift, we have a huge amount of extra drag, and that's where the terrible fuel specs come from. We're dragging this thing through the air. It is generating some lift. You could think of it really as a powered parachute almost. You know, those guys have the little fan on the back, and they've got their parachute, and they can climb and they can descend and they can go fly around on it. But that shuttle on top generates a whole lot of drag, and we're pretty much drag limited. A normal takeoff, well, the last takeoff with a relatively light shuttle at Edwards calculated out to about a 11,000 foot takeoff distance.
And how about emergency protocols? Let's say a couple engines suck in some geese and you lose them, something like that.
Well, a couple engines would be, it would be a very difficult situation. If you had altitude and airspeed, it would be a drift down situation, because with the shuttle on board, you don't have the thrust to keep it flying really on two engines. So three engine performance is marginal. And in an emergency, say an engine failure at during takeoff or at or after our decision speed, after V1 would push it up to J power, which gives us an additional probably 2,000 or 3,000 pounds of thrust per engine, depending on the density altitude where we're flying, and we'd start dumping fuel immediately and plan on making an emergency return. In the history of the airplane or the program, that happened one time on a takeoff from Edwards, and the shuttle was on board, and I'm not sure where they were going. It was, I think it happened in 95, and they took off, and they made one big teardrop, got up to probably 1,500, 2,000 feet or so out over the desert to the northeast of Edwards Air Force Base, and they were dumping fuel and went to J power. It was an indication of an engine fire, and there was in fact a fire. It wasn't a false indication, and they had an engine failure. They shut it down once they had some airspeed and came back and landed. But with four engines going and the shuttle on board after takeoff, your climb rate's around 800 feet per minute, so you don't have a lot to play with.
Now, all this history is coming to an end now. What's next for the SCA, and after the shuttles are delivered? And I suppose I should ask, too, what's next for you?
The shuttle carrier has a very uncertain future. It's anybody's guess what it will actually end up doing. In another week or so, the doors will be closed on it. It'll be sitting in kind of a non-flying storage status, and there is no scheduled use for the airplane, but it's too early to actually send it to the boneyard.
Well, looking back in your own personal history flying the aircraft, what's impressed you most, or maybe I should say, what will you most remember about flying the jet?
Well, I think probably the most impressive part or the most impressive thing I've seen is the impact that it has on the people of the country. I've been around the space program for quite a while, and I've been flying airplanes for a long time before that, 10 years with airlines and 5 years active duty Air Force prior to that. So I've been around airplanes a lot. I've been around people a lot. I've been to lots of air shows. I have lots of friends that are in every different part of aviation, and we all speak the same language. But when I got involved with the shuttle carrier airplane, I thought, it's an honor to be part of it. But on the very first flight, when I was actually involved in carrying the shuttle, it was amazing to see that with almost no advance notice at all, we could land in at an Air Force base in Oklahoma or in Missouri or in West Texas. And people just came out of everywhere to see it. The symbol of that the shuttle represents for, let's say, the technological accomplishments of NASA and the American people is something that I suppose those of us in flying just take for granted, and we don't appreciate what it really represents outside the flying public anyway.
We've been speaking with NASA SCA pilot Bill Brockett. I'm Glenn Pugh for AvWeb.com. Thanks for listening.
Brought to you by Bose, presenting their most advanced pilot headset ever, the Bose A20 Aviation Headset. It provides acclaimed noise reduction along with a comfortable fit, clear audio, and Bluetooth connectivity.